them to, as if she only had to get the order correct for God to hear her fervent prayers. Нет, нет, not normal. Not at all. Even I recognized this, young as I was. She was more than a fool for God, she was a fanatic. Why, after giving birth to 4 daughters, she was desperate to bear a boy, an heir, and to achieve this, she had the monk Serafim of Sarov canonized. And after that grand ceremony, Nikolai and Alexandra crept down to the spring, where the monk was known to have worked miracles hundreds of years earlier. And there, in the dead of night, they bathed naked. Just the 2 of them. The next day there were a number of known miracles. Children healed of terrible maladies. A blind woman who regained her sight. An invalid who walked for the first time in 10 years. And soon thereafter, Alexandra became pregnant with Alexei. Some say it was an act of God himself, but why would he do such a dark thing, give Russia such a troubled heir? Rather, I think it was this inescapable Russian fate. But sure, while our Empress was cold on the outside, she was at the same time wildly passionate on the inside, and in this way so very, very Russian. In the carnal sense, she and the Emperor were the most loving of couples. In their early letters to one another, there is even mention of their pet names for their genitalia. And this from a granddaughter of that tight Victoria. Ради Бога, dear Lord, Alexandra must be rolling in death, knowing that those pet names for their privates have been published around the globe. Late that very same night, my uncle and I were carrying a trunk marked N.A. No. 12, albums, meaning it was Nikolai Alexandrovich's 12th trunk, the one filled with photo albums. We proceeded from the maple living room, a very attractive 2-story room covered with bare rugs and filled with mementos. It was here the family often lunched together in private, and passed into what was known as the corner living room. It had not been redone in the style moderne, but rather left in the older classical style. And as Uncle Vanya and I carried the trunk around a small gilt table and 2 chairs, I looked over and saw Alexandra Fyodorovna herself staring up at a large tapestry of a woman, her 3 young children gathered around her. It was after midnight, and despite the chaos swirling around the imperial family, the Empress just stood there, not so much as flinching. Why does the Empress stare at that rug on the wall? I asked my uncle as we passed through the main doors from their apartments, the very doors once guarded by their faithful Negroes, the huge men dressed in turbans and colorful dress. Who is the woman pictured? Marie Antoinette, he replied in his deep voice, leaving it at that, as if I should know. Of course, I didn't have the faintest idea. We continued down the long hall to the rotunda, where all was gathered. But later, as I carried baggage from Alexandra's infamous mauve boudoir, I saw a painting of the same woman hanging on the wall. As it turns out, this was the second thing I learned that night about the Tsaritsa, her obsession with violent death, which took the form of her fascination with Marie Antoinette. It seems that the Empress, so mystical, so fatalistic, had suspected for years what awaited her own family. Though, never in all of history has an imperial brood, the symbol of a nation, been so crudely butchered. Children and servants and pets all liquidated, all except a young kitchen boy. To hell with the comunisti. How strange is history. the Alexander Palace was preserved as such, just the way the Emperor and Empress left it when they walked out the door. It was kept that way until World War II, when the Nazis used it for their headquarters, and the nearby Great Palace for a stable and garage. This was during the 900-day siege of Leningrad, as Peter, Sankt Peterburg, had been renamed by the Bolsheviki, and those were the days of utter hell on earth. It was during this time that the Gestapo assumed the basement beneath the Tsar's wing as a place of torture, and to this day, the gardens of that stately palace are filled with an untold number of bodies. At the end of the war, the palace and its rooms were damaged, but not horribly so. The German booby traps were found and defused just 5 hours before they were to blow, and Nikolai and Alexandra's apartments could have been easily restored. Instead, some Soviet general decided to wipe away any memory of Nikolai the Bloody and Alexandra the Niemka, the German. And so today only two of Nikolai's rooms remain, his gorgeous steel-modern office and his cozy warm reception room, which the hypocritical Red General kept for his own personal use. One other odd thing, and this concerns Rasputin. Late in the fall of 1916, before my time with the Romanovs, that mysterious monk with the long, greasy hair and sharp nose finally began to understand the hatred against him, that many powerful princes and grand dukes believed he was leading the dynasty and country to ruin. In fact, he correctly supposed that he would soon be dead, or more precisely, murdered. With this in mind, Rasputin wrote a note to his Tsar and Tsaritsa, which was only delivered to them after he was killed by young Prince Felix Yusupov, who was married to the Tsar's own niece, a pretty young thing who died just a short while ago, actually, in 67. In his prophetic letter, Rasputin wrote, "Tsar of the land of Russia, if it was your relations who have wrought my death, then no one of your family, that is to say none of your children or relations, will remain alive for more than 2 years. They will be killed by the Russian people." Strange, is it not? Rasputin was murdered in December of 1916. Poisoned, stabbed, shot, and finally drowned. It took all of that to kill that powerful peasant, and he was right. Nikolai and Alexandra, their children, and many other Romanovs, in total almost 20, would be dead within the predicted time. How in the name of God did Rasputin, the holy mad monk, know this? It's almost enough to make one a believer. So, Alexandra knew well what had happened to Marie Antoinette, just as Rasputin's words reverberated in her chest with each beat of her weak heart. But let me make one thing very clear. The Romanovs never gave up hope. To the very end itself, even as they descended those 23 steps in the depth of that night, they never stopped praying, hoping, believing that they would be rescued by a storm of 300 officers. Yes, there were many depressing hours in each one of those days, but Nikolai and Alexandra kept praying to their God, kept hoping for dear friends to save them, friends who in the end never appeared, which is perhaps not that surprising. After all, while 90% of the Russian people did not want them dead, the same 90% did not want them back on the throne either. Such was the horrible paradox. Saving them would have meant restoring the autocracy, which was at that point untenable to almost all of Russia. And so, the long wait for the second note. I found the first note to the Tsar and his family on the morning of the 20th, and then carried the reply to Father Storozhev on the afternoon of the 21st. I think all of us were expecting, or at least hoping, that Sister Antonina would bring a reply on the 22nd. Instead, she failed to appear, leaving us awash in anxiety. How did the time pass? Well, for starters, that morning of the 22nd, the weather on the street was glorious. Sunny and pleasant, about 16 degrees of warmth. But soon it was more than 20 Celsius inside. "Dear Lord in heaven," moaned Nikolai Alexandrovich, sweat beading on his brow. "It's been 2 weeks now. 2 solid weeks. And they still haven't decided whether or not we can open a window. It's absolutely inhumane." "Of course it is, my sweetheart," said Alexandra Fyodorovna, standing behind him, a pair of scissors in her hands. "Now be still before I do you serious damage."
"Better you than them."
"I'll hear no such thing." She'd cut his hair for the first time ever a month earlier. This was the second attempt. Just 15 minutes earlier, Nyuta, the Tsaritsa's maid, had laid a sheet in a corner of the dining room, then placed a chair atop that. And now Nikolai Alexandrovich sat there trying to be still, which wasn't his nature. Already he had paced for an hour around the dining table. He needed more time outside. A half hour once in the morning and once in the afternoon just wasn't enough. While the Empress was trimming his hair, my duty was to entertain the Tsarevich, and as such, we were playing Troika. He sat in the wheeled chaise, and I pushed, obeying his every command. "Off into the woods, faster," ordered Alexei Nikolaevich. "Alyosha," beckoned his father. "Alyosha, I want you two to be careful. Am I clear?"
"Of course, Papa."
As I slowed the vehicle of Alexei's imaginary escape, one of the girls appeared, the front of her frock all dusted white.
"Look at me! Look at your Nastinka!" proclaimed Anastasia Nikolaevna.
"Whatever have you gotten into, Dragaya?" asked her father, entirely amused.
"Cook Kretonov is teaching us how to bake bread."
"Really?" said her mother, unable to hide her surprise.
"Yes, he showed us how to knead it, and it's rising right now. I'm sure it's going to be delicious."
Nikolai Alexandrovich smiled and said, "I have no doubt about that. Pretty soon you girls will know how to do everything in the kitchen."
"I love you all and kiss you 1,000 times, she said with her usual flair, as she spun and hurried off.
Alexandra Fyodorovna smiled after her and said, "In spite of everything, they're growing up."
"I suppose they are," agreed her husband.
"I do hope Anya keeps growing, though. Her legs are too short, her waist is too thick."
"That's the least of our worries."
"Yes, of course."
Again, the air ordered me off into the woods, and I turned the troika and started our pursuit of wild Siberian tigers and bears. Suddenly, however, a real monster appeared, in the form of a guard, who blocked our route into the living room. He was tall, big-shouldered, had a long, greasy mustache, and he wore a filthy tunic and rumpled, baggy pants. From his shoulder hung a long rifle with a rusty bayonet on the end, and hanging from his belt, of course, was a hand grenade.
"Get back," he ordered.
I halted the chair and looked from the guard to the Tsar, then back to the guard.
"The women are here," said the guard, his voice as deep as it was abrupt. "You must return to your rooms, they will wash the floors."
"But can't you see I'm cutting my husband's hair?"
protested Alexandra Fyodorovna, glaring imperiously at him.
"By order of the commandant, all of you must return to the far room."
"Just 5 more minutes," she said,
not as a question, not as a request, but as a statement of fact.
Now!
But Nikolai Alexandrovich, brushing off his shoulders as he rose from his chair, calmly said, "Actually, Alex, I think you're finished. If you take any more off, I'll be bald." I watched as she looked momentarily into the soft eyes of her husband, then, her eyes burning, turned her attention on the guard. Her lips trembled as if she wanted to lash out at him. Her skin got all blotchy and red. And then, in one quick swoop, the Empress threw her cutting shears on the dinner table, gathered up her long skirt, and stormed out of the dining room. "You must forgive my wife. She slept poorly last night," said Nikolai Alexandrovich, starting after. "Come, Alyosha, let's get out of here so the charwomen can clean." I followed after my master, pushing the wheeling chaise and air out of the dining room, into the girls' room, to the left, and into their bedchamber, where Alexandra Fyodorovna stood, her face bowed into both hands. Weeping quietly, she shook, and I witnessed the Tsar go up and embrace her from behind. In the flash of a second, she spun around, throwing herself into his arms. "There, there, my sunshine," he said, kissing the top of her head. "Forgive me, Nikki. Forgive me, please, my darling. I know my greatest sin is my irritability. You know how hot-tempered I am. I want to be a better woman, and I try. I really do, for long periods. I am really patient, and then out breaks my bad temper. It is not so difficult to bear great trials, but these little buzzing mosquitoes are so trying." "Of course they are, my dearest. I long to warm and comfort others. You know I do, but I don't feel drawn to those around me here. I am cold toward them, and this too is wrong of me." "All that matters is that we seven are together and safe." "Yes, yes, of course, my love, you're right, always right. Oh, how I love you, my treasure, my life, what bliss you have given me." She sighed, pressed her cheek against his, and, keeping her voice low, said, "But where is the sister today? Why didn't she come with another letter? Oh, Nikki, I'm so scared. We will hear more, won't we? Promise we will." "I swear with my heart, all my heart." I stood silent and still behind the wheeling chaise, and both Alexei and I, as if staring upon a silent film, didn't flinch, only stared on as the Tsar whispered something in her ear, and she half laughed and half cried, her polished nails digging into his muscular back. A few moments later, I heard the rustle of clothing and turned to the open doorway. All four grand duchesses, their hands and long skirts powdered with flour for the first time in their lives, were looking upon their parents as well. Hearing them, the Tsar turned, his face reddening. "Well, so, all of us are here, are we?" Tatyana Nikolaevna, the second daughter and the most responsible of them all, softly said by way of explanation, "The floors are to be cleaned." "So they are," replied her father as he tugged at his collar. "Gospody, dear Lord, but it's hot in here, isn't it, children? So, who'd like to play a game of bezique?" Thus, for the next 2 hours, we passed the time playing a type of pinochle. Not just the seven Romanovs and me in the bedchamber, but Dr. Botkin, Demidova, and the footman Trapp, all of us day by day compressing into one unit. Only Cook Haritonov was allowed to carry on as before, and his meager cooking filled the whole of the closed-up house with its smells. Potatoes, beetroot, and more compote. That was the lunch we later took at 1 o'clock, though by that time it was so stuffy, the heat so intense, that no one much felt like eating. Really, it was broiling in there. Not a movement of air. On the street, it was 30 degrees. So God only knew how hot it was inside. The Reds had evicted the Ipatyev family with barely any notice, and after lunch the Emperor found one of Mr. Ipatyev's own books, Sea Stories by Belamour, which the engineer had left behind as he fled. Choosing a passage, the Tsar read aloud to his son until close to 2:30, when we were allowed into the garden for an entire hour, on account of the intensity of the heat. All of us went out, including the Empress. As innocent, as unsuspecting as they would be on the night of July 16th to 17th, the Romanovs descended those 23 steps, passed out the door, and into that untidy little garden. Dr. Botkin and Trapp managed the rolling chaise, and Nikolai Alexandrovich himself carried his son down the steps. I followed the girls, who followed their father, as he paced a circle, while the heir and his mother took refuge from the fearful heat beneath the branches of a lilac bush. There was nothing to cling to in our lives but our regimen, and at 4:30, just as punctual as ever, I helped serve tea in the drawing room, where all 7 Romanovs and Dr. Botkin were gathered. Cook Kharitonov sliced some of the fresh bread, which was still hot, and I carried it out on a plate along with a bit of butter, handed it to Demidova, who in turn placed it on the tea table. This produced no end of delight for the Grand Duchesses, who were quite proud of their creation. It wasn't white bread, the preferred sort of the nobility, for both Alexandra and Kharitonov had been carefully hoarding what little white flour we had for Alexei, thinking it more healthy, more digestible. Rather, these princesses had made the real Russian chorny chleb, black bread that was dark and earthy and so deliciously sour. An endless stream of questions and comments and praise followed. I was just returning to the kitchen when the door burst open, and 6 unknown men stomped into the room, led by none other than the commandant himself. A flash of unspoken terror shot through us all. Had Sister Antonina been found out? Was the rescue plot so quickly dashed? His voice trembling like a schoolboy's, Nikolai Alexandrovich quickly pushed himself to his feet and said, "Good afternoon, gentlemen. May I?" Avdeyev looked in Nikolashka's direction and muttered,
"Son,
sit."
"But sit down and be quiet."
Good soldier that he was, the Tsar sank back down, and all of us watched in terror as this group of thugs moved from the drawing room into the dining room and then proceeded into the bedchambers. Maria Nikolaevna and I, peering through the open doorways, watched and tried to discern what they were saying, but of course it was impossible. Their voices were low and deep. A lot of grumbling went on. For what purpose had they come? I looked over at the Tsaritsa, who was clutching the Tsar's hand, her eyes clenched shut in fright. Would they search the rooms, tear apart their things in search of evidence against them? Might the medicines be discovered? But then, the group of men was going from one whitewashed window to the next, and I whispered to Maria, "It looks like they're checking out which windows can be opened. They must be from the regional Soviet." And so it became evident that they were, in fact, a Soviet, a council, a committee, that had been formed to decide which, if any, windows might be unglued. For more than 20 minutes these Reds went from room to room, from window to window, discussing all this with the utmost intensity. They must have been terribly afraid of anarchists or conspirators. That is, worried that one group might take a shot at the Tsar through that open window, or fearful that another bunch might try to rescue their monarch via an opening. Finally, in the end, they seemed to agree not to agree. Perhaps they had a report to make. Perhaps they were afraid of answering with their lives. In any case, this group of six men emerged from the bedchambers, staring at the imperial family as if they were circus freaks. As they headed out, Nikolai Alexandrovich rose again to his feet, pleading yet once more, "We would be most obliged for a single window to be opened. You can see for yourself not only how hot it is in here, but how unhealthy it is. Please, I ask you to consider the health of my wife and children, all of whom are suffering." Commandant Avdeyev glared at his Nikolashka, and the Tsar continued, saying, "On another matter, we would also be happy to be given any work. For example, we would appreciate the opportunity to clear the garden in the rear, which is quite a mess. I myself would greatly like to saw more wood, to cut and stack it." "At this point, nothing of that sort is permitted," snapped Avdeyev as he and the others departed. Depressed, forlorn, the Romanovs melted back into the heat, which could only be described as colossal. The family sipped at their tea and nibbled at the bread, which only minutes earlier had provided such joy, such pride, but was now only so much of nothing. After a few minutes, Nikolai Alexandrovich began to read aloud to his son, while Alexander Fyodorovna took out some cards and began to lay patience. Two of the girls played dominoes, but, of course, not for money, which Alexandra, with her grandmother's tight Victorian morals, would never allow. Very little happened during the rest of the day, at least not until Vladimir Nikolaevich, Dr. Derevenko, came to check on the health of the heir. By that time of day, nearly six, I was back in the kitchen helping Kharitonov with the preparations for the meager dinner that would be served at 8. Cutlets and leftover macaroni tart. It was Demidova herself, her face forlorn, who came into the kitchen. "Vladimir Nikolaevich has arrived." She tried not to say it, but could not restrain herself from whispering, "Nichivo." Nothing. So, there was no news, no reply to our reply. Sure, even the Tsaritsa's maid knew we were awaiting more news from the outside, for that was how the Tsar and Tsaritsa handled this. No one was excluded, which was very democratic of them. "Lyonka, the doctor requests hot water," said Demidova. "Does," I replied. A few minutes later, bearing a bowl of hot water, I walked into the bedchamber and found not just the doctor, but also Commandant Avdeyev himself seated at the foot of the heir's bed. "Ah, thank you, Lyonka," said Vladimir Nikolaevich. The doctor, who had been using his special device to electrify Alexei's knee and thereby stimulate circulation, placed the mechanism and tangle of wires aside. He then beckoned me forward. "Come here, boy." And so I stepped toward him and held the bowl as he dipped in a cloth and wrung it out. For the next 10 minutes I didn't move as the doctor applied warm compresses to the boy's left arm. And during that entire time, Avdeyev just sat there yawning, scratching his nose, not doing anything but making it impossible for the emperor or empress to pose a single question to Derevenko. Most disturbing, though, was that the doctor simply went about his usual business without any pretense that he knew something was going on. Not one of us spoke during his treatment of the heir, and 15 minutes later, Vladimir Nikolaevich simply packed up his medical kit and departed without so much as raising an eyebrow. Or, our hopes for that matter. Shortly before dinner, the girls washed their parents' pocket handkerchiefs. And later, after dinner, all of us gathered in the drawing room and listened to Nikolai Alexandrovich read aloud. The heat and the lack of air continued to be intense, and I went to bed soon after Alexei Nikolaevich. Sometime toward midnight, a huge storm came upon us. The wind ferocious, the rain strong. The first crashes of lightning and thunder woke me, and then I lay awake for a long time, listening to the heavy drops beat against the metal roof of the House of Special Purpose. Thus ended our first long day of waiting, which seemed extraordinarily calm in comparison to the next. 6. June 23rd, 1918, started out to be a lovely day. A Sunday it was, and the heavy rains of the night had washed away the heat. Weeks earlier, the Bolsheviki had painted the thermometer with lime as well, but even they realized the cruelty, not to mention the senselessness, of depriving the Romanovs their only divertissement. That little glass thermometer that hung outside the girl's room was the family's only contact with the outer world, the only vehicle of news from their lost beyond. And so, after much protest from Nikolai Alexandrovich, the whitewash was scratched from a tiny corner of the window pane and from the thermometer itself, and in this way were we able to note the dramatic moods of the Siberian day. Without fail, master and servant alike followed the fluctuating mercury with the utmost interest. One of the girls would pause in her reading, jump off her bed, check the measuring device. The emperor would slow in his pacing of the rooms, bend over, see what God had decided for the day. Demidova would steal a glance as she straightened things. Even the guards posted inside found it a welcome distraction. When the household awoke for the new day, it was 13 degrees of warmth on the street. Inside it was nearly as cool, for the powerful winds of the night had not only swayed the trees, but poured through every crack of the Ipatyev house. For the first time in days, the stale air had been forced away, and in the rooms it was pleasant, refreshing, almost delightful. It gave us hope, truly, it did. And early that morning, Alexandra Fyodorovna sat in bed, writing to the mother of a wounded soldier about how one shouldn't lose faith, that God would bring better days. Yes, sure, her belief in the Almighty gave her remarkable inner strength, and she often said, "Don't worry. The deadly illness must be born, then the organism becomes stronger, and life becomes easier and lighter." Unfortunately, the day's events soon took a turn for the worse. I was just stuffing bits of charcoal into the samovar when I heard short, heavy steps. Turning, I saw Nyuta standing there, her face flushed red, her breathing quick and short. "Lyonka, quickly! Water for Evgeny Sergeyevich." I was constantly carrying water this way and that, but my first thought, my automatic one, was of course that something horrible had happened to the Herr Tsarevich, for all of us knew that death forever lingered in his shadow. Had Alexei Nikolaevich fallen from his bed? Bumped his toe? Sneezed too hard? So casual an event could easily prove a mortal catastrophe for the boy, and those were the darkest of our days, actually, when the Tsarevich suffered, when we feared his end was imminent, when the blood flooded his joints, swelled his skin, twisted his limbs, the boy's screams of pain, against which medicine was then helpless, were as piercing as a bullet. There was no escape, not for him, not for any of us, least of all the Empress, who would sit by the little one for days on end, without sleeping, without eating. She couldn't hold her child, no, that would be too painful for him. All that she could do was kiss his brow, his cheeks, and listen in guilt as he moaned an occasional, "Mommy." Only when he was back on our side, clinging to life again, would Alexandra Fyodorovna retire, collapsing in her own bed, from which she wouldn't emerge for days upon end. And that was when we were called in to entertain him. The sisters, both pairs, big and little, and eventually me, of course. For only I took equal delight in the heir's treasures. His bits of wire, the rusty nails, as well as his prized coins, the very ones he had positioned on the train tracks back in Tsarskaya. "Look at what Papa's locomotive did to this kopeck," he would exclaim to me, showing the flattest of them all. Fearing the worst for the heir, I poured a large bowl of water, grabbed a small cloth, which I threw over my shoulder, and started quickly out. Passing through the hall in which I slept, I headed into the dining room and began to circle the large dark oak table. "Нет, нет, молодой человек!" "No, no, young man," called Nyuta from the doorway into the main parlor. "This way, in here!" Confused, I came to a halt, sloshing the water from my bowl, but was it not Alexei Nikolaevich who was in need? "Come on, Ronka, hurry!" I changed my direction, circled back around, and followed Demidova into the parlor, whereupon the commotion led me to the front of the room. Heading around the large potted palm, I entered the alcove, where I saw the Empress, her second daughter, Tatyana Nikolaevna, and not Alexei, but Dr. Botkin, who lay moaning on the reed settee that served as his bed. "Yevgeny Sergeyevich has had an attack of the kidneys," whispered the Tsaritsa's maid to me. I don't know what it says about the Empress, a woman of extraordinary complexity, but the suffering of others always brought out the best in her. From all the books I've read, I've come to understand she was horrendously insecure, pathologically so. Her friends were either totally hers and under her complete domination, for make no doubt about it, she was amazingly strong-willed, or they were simply her enemies. There existed for her nothing between those extremes of devotion and rejection. And yet, when someone was in need, friend or foe, this shy woman, whose mother had perished when she was 6, rallied with amazing inner strength and determination. More than anything else, she could identify with pain and suffering. In this century, however, there has been no woman more maligned or misunderstood than the Empress Alexandra Fyodorovna, consort to the Tsar of all the Russias. Just as there has been no woman whose gross mistakes, no matter how inadvertent, have hurt, even killed, so many millions. A wise woman she was not. Passionate, loving, beautiful, sure, but worldly ignorant. More damage she could not have done to her beloved adopted Russia. This scandal she caused by inviting Rasputin into the royal palace was outrageous. Imagine, while the Tsar was off fighting the Germans, that stupid Yurodstvo, holy fool, was all but signing imperial decrees. Well, Alexandra Fyodorovna placed a glass thermometer between Dr. Botkin's lips, then turned to me and beckoned. "Lonka, the water, please." And then, as I stood there, the Tsaritsa bathed the doctor's big red face, wiping it gently, even professionally, you might say. After all, Alexandra Fyodorovna and her older daughters, the big pair, Olga Nikolaevna and Tatyana Nikolaevna, became nurses soon after the outbreak of the Great War. Daily they went to the wards and the surgery theaters. Many noble women of Peterburg thought it outrageous that an empress would bloody her hands, quite literally. Many gossiped that their Tsaritsa was wasting her efforts on a few soldiers, many of whom she befriended, many of whom died, when she should be sweeping through as many hospitals as possible, making herself seen as widely as she could. But my mistress was of the strongest conviction otherwise. She was Matushka, the dear mother. There were those in dire need. She had to do whatever it took, even the lowliest work, and she was often seen carrying away amputated arms and legs, and worse. Alexandra Fyodorovna checked the thermometer and said, 38.8. Not good. The pain persists, Yevgeny Sergeyevich?
Does,
weakly replied the doctor. Then I believe an injection is called for, am I right? He nodded.
Would you be so kind?
The Tsaritsa turned to her number two daughter, Tanichka. Prepare me a syringe of morphia.
Certainly, Mama.
Nyuta, Lyonka, you are excused.
Das,
replied Demidova, backing away. I likewise muttered, bowed my head, and retreated. Glancing back once, I witnessed Tatyana Nikolaevna confidently pulling a glass syringe from the doctor's brown leather bag. Breakfast that morning was served not too terribly late. We had our morning inspection, and then we served the morning tea and bread. Everyone was gathered there in the dining room except Dr. Botkin, who was resting more comfortably, and Alexandra Fyodorovna, who remained by his side for the rest of the morning. The early drama thus melted into our routine. The Tsar paced the dining room, the girls made their beds, then the older pair started reading, while the younger girls came and sat at the dinner table and began to draw. I wheeled about the air. Cook Haritonov fussed in the kitchen over our meager provisions, and Demidova and Trupp emptied the enamel chamber pots employed for night use. Our morning walk in the garden was scheduled for 10:30, and we all anticipated this silently, but with great urgency. Just as the day before, however, the doors were suddenly and unexpectedly thrown open. It happened at 10 precisely, and this time it was but two men, neither of whom we had ever seen, who marched into our world. I was just wheeling the air around the dinner table when they stormed in, proceeding directly past their former master, as if he were a stupid dog. I pulled the wheeling chair to a quick stop, and both Alexei Nikolaevich and I watched as they continued through the room. They carried not guns or grenades, but tools, entering the girls' room in utter silence, for all visitors to the house of special purpose were under strict red orders not to speak with us. Raising his right hand, the heir bid me forward, and I rolled him thus, creeping around the table, past the chairs, and then, like the Tsar himself who came up behind us, we cautiously peered through the doorless opening. Several of the Grand Duchesses sat on their beds, and we were all transfixed as the men quietly but surely set to work on one of the windows. It took but moments, and as we witnessed the seemingly unbelievable, I saw the Tsar's brow rise in surprise, witnessed the dumbfounded shake of his head, received the thrilled wink of his eye. The two workmen did the impossible. They unglued a single, wonderful, beautiful window. "Oi," softly muttered the heir in joy. Just as quickly as they had come, so the men left. Their heads hung, their eyes cast to the floor, their lips sealed. At first, none of us moved. I think we were expecting the fat red pig Commandant Avdeyev to come marching in. Instead, the workmen departed, closing the outer doors, and then, we poured toward the open window.
Papa!
Called Olga Nikolaevna, leaping from her bed.
Oi, какая прелесть!
Oh, what a joy! Shouted Tatiana Nikolaevna.
Ура!
Shouted the heir as I wheeled him to the window that overlooked his former empire.
Thank the Lord!
Proclaimed the Tsar, sucking the air as deeply as he could. Huge, billowing gusts of air swarmed upon us, and we all gathered around, held our arms out, felt the breeze swirl around and lift our hearts like kites into the boundless sky.
"Isn't the fragrance tasty?" said Nikolai Alexandrovich.
"I can smell every garden in town,"
proclaimed Anastasia Nikolaevna, squinching up her shoulders and her nose and drinking it all in.
"This is heaven."
We heard her steps, heard her voice, scared and worried, as she called out,
"What is it, Nikki? What's happened? What?"
"Look, Mama!" exclaimed the heir.
"They opened the window!"
She froze at the threshold, clasped both hands over her mouth. The Tsar, laughing, turned to his consort and held out his arms. The next moment, they were embracing. I rolled Alexei Nikolaevich right up to the edge of the sill, and he grabbed onto it, clutching to all that might yet be. That was all. It only took that little bit, a single open window, to feed the royal family with delightful hope.
"Oh, Nikki, dusha moya!"
"My soul," said the Empress, clasping her husband. "You see, my love, as you've always said, after the rain..."
"Sun."
"After the darkness?"
"Light."
"And after the illness?"
"Health."
"Exactly," said the Tsar. "We mustn't give up faith."
"No, my love. Never."
But the luck of Nikolai and his brood was like an ocean liner, very difficult to turn around. At that particular moment, Anastasia Nikolaevna took it upon herself not simply to poke her head out the window, not simply to stretch outside as far as she could, but to actually climb up on the windowsill.
A character she was, full of energy and mischief.
One of her royal cousins had long ago taught her to climb trees, a habit that she could never be broken of, no matter her rank or the gender.
"Careful, Nastinka,"
chided number three sister, Maria Nikolaevna.
"Oi, Mashka, stop your worrying. I just want the air all around me. I want it to lift me up, to carry me away, far away."
Her father, the Tsar, turned from his wife, saw his daughter perched on the ledge two floors above ground, and shouted,
"Boże mój!"
My God!
"Anastasia Nikolaevna, you get down right this moment!"
"But, Papa..."
"Now!"
"Oh, all right, I..."
But just as she turned her back to the endless world beyond, just as she readied herself to jump back into the whole of our existence, a blast rang out. More specifically, a shot. The next instant, the wall of the house, not but a few centimeters from Anastasia's head, was struck by a bullet, and bits of stucco and brick exploded into the air. As much by fear as anything else, the poor child was thrown into the room, where she landed upon two of her sisters. They all screamed and came crashing down onto the floor, collapsing in a terrible heap of arms and legs. Before I knew it, before I could even think what to do, the Tsar grabbed the wheeling chaise from me, jerking his son from the environs of the window and pulling him back against the far wall. Terrified, Alexandra Fyodorovna cried out and threw herself forward, grabbing for her youngest daughter, screaming, "Anya!" All of a sudden, a huge wail rose above everything else, a terrified cry, as the girl replied, "Mama!" I stumbled back, plastering myself against the wall. Before my eyes, Alexandra made a frantic examination of her youngest daughter. Limbs, head, torso. But no. Anastasia was not wounded, she was unscathed, merely terrified. As the girl broke into a flow of tears, Alexandra clutched her daughter to her chest, cradling her and sobbing as well. A moment later, the three other grand duchesses fell upon them, and this heap of womanhood shook like a volcano until finally, for the first time, they erupted. All this time, all these months, not one of them had broken down, not one of them had let go, and now, they bellowed forth. "My babies!" cried Alex, poring over her three other daughters, Olya's hand, Tanichka's head, Mashka's cheek. "My precious babies!" The Tsar turned the wheeling chaise around, pushed his son to this mass of family, and they all melded into a heap, mother and daughters on the floor, son slightly higher on his chaise and father standing firmly above them. They all clutched and grabbed for one another, Alex hanging onto her Nikki's leg. For the first time, the only time, I saw amazing pain boil in the Tsar's body. He closed his eyes, bit his bottom lip. Strong. He had to be strong for his family, for Russia, for God. But he couldn't. No more. He had reached his limit. And for fear of totally falling apart, he dared not move. He simply let his terrified family drape from him like a defeated flag. With every bit of courage he had left, he pinched his lips, lest he cry out, clenched his eyes shut, lest he spill his fear, and his face passed from white to crimson. And yet there was only so much he could control. A tear emerged in his right eye. Two tears. They were huge and round, and slowly, quite slowly, they began to travel down his cheek and into his beard. Everyone came flooding into the room. Demidova, Trap, Kharitonov, the guards, and, of course, finally, the commandant himself.
"What have you idiots done?" Avdeyev yelled at the family. "You, citizen Romanov, were you trying to escape? We open a window, and what do you do a minute later, try to run away? Is that it, hey, Nikolashka, you coward? Trying to get away from us?"
I thought the Tsar was going to rip off the man's head. I saw his body quiver, his fists curl into knots of rock. But Nikolai Alexandrovich didn't move. No, ever fatalistic, he silently bore the insult as he had always carried everything, crown and all. I, he said, barely able to speak, let alone control himself, would never leave my family.
Well, that's not what the guard down below said. He said he looked up and saw one of you ready to jump out.
That fool nearly killed my daughter.
They have strict orders to shoot upon—
The Emperor flung his arm out, pointing at the doorway as he screamed,
Leave us!
Что?
What? Coarsely replied Avdeyev.
Let me remind you that you blood drinkers are the prisoners here. In case you don't yet understand, I am the commandant and I give the orders around—
Get out!
But—
The Tsar's eyes flared. His entire face flashed red with fury and, fired with the spirits of his ancestors, he shouted,
Get out! Now!
Such a moment I will never forget. For the first and only time did Nikolai Alexandrovich seem like a true Russian Tsar, an iron-fisted one. He was Ivan, and Peter, and Catherine all in one, and Lviv crumbled in a second. The commandant all but started shaking, all but bowed to the ground, for in the end of ends, this was his Tsar. And at the very least he would grant him this, the few square meters upon which the august family was now huddled, as their territory and theirs alone. With no further protest, Avdeyev withdrew. And so did we, the rest of their meager attendants. Kharitonov fell away. Demidova. Trapp. Even Botkin, who had come at the last moment, ill though he was. I made my way out of the room as well. I slowly walked to the passage, to the dining room, the door of which had been removed, of course, and the last I looked back, Nikolai was dropping to his knees. They were all coming together, all seven of them. Holding hands, they formed a tight circle, bowed their heads in prayer. Alexandra and Tatiana started chanting a hymn. Nikolai spoke a prayer and...
7. Such a kind man was Nikolai II.
So sweet, so tender, and gentle.
He loved nothing more than his family and his country. He hated disagreements, either within his vast squabbling house, or among his ministers, both great and small, or anywhere else, for that matter, within his enormous realm. That was the Tsar I knew then, and the Tsar I've since grown to know in my books. Bloodshed was not at all what he wanted, and yet any fool would admit that that was his legacy. When Batushka, the dear father, departed this world, he left behind a vast sea of blood. His own, his family's, his country's. Up until the iron-fisted totalitarian rule of the Red Tsars, the Communisti, who made the terrible Ivan look like a choir boy, his reign was one of the most violent in all the history of Russia. One must not forget that it was during the reign of Nicholas II that two disastrous wars, two bitter revolutions, and countless pogroms befell Holy Mother Russia. And though Tsar Nikolai wanted nothing more than to avoid violence, though many of the disasters were not of his doing, virtually all of them were his fault, because he was Tsar, Russian Tsar, absolute Tsar, Orthodox Tsar. When you look back through the decades, it now seems utterly obvious that there was no way it could be done. No way an autocrat could rule so vast a country, at least not without complete terror and oppression. Why, during his arrest, the former Tsar read the anti-Semitic Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which he found very timely reading matter. He never learned, however, that the book was an entire fabrication, composed by his own Tsarist secret police, whose duty it was to maintain order for their master, but who instead incited the hate and riots that toppled him. So, in the end, this is how Nikolai II must be viewed, a very caring man of moderate abilities who, although utterly devoted to his country, was unable to transform the